Case number 2011-41063, United States of America versus Jesus Rodriguez Escareno.
May it please the court. Good morning. Tim Crooks for the appellant, Jesus Rodriguez Escareno. Mr. Rodriguez Escareno was convicted of illegal reentry after deportation, and he received a 16-level guideline enhancement based on his prior federal conviction for conspiracy to distribute methamphetamine. The sole issue presented by this appeal is whether the district court plainly erred in applying that enhancement. And we believe that the answer to that question is yes. Turning first to the first and second prongs of plain error review, which are whether there's an error and whether that error is plain, distribution of methamphetamine is a drug trafficking offense under Guideline Section 2L1.2, and Application Note 5 says that conspiring to commit the offenses in 2L1.2B1 also qualifies a defendant for the same sentencing enhancement as the object offense. The question presented by this appeal is whether the federal conspiracy that is proscribed in 21 U.S.C. Section 846 is covered by the term conspiring in Application Note 5. And we submit that it is plainly not covered based on three well-settled principles of law, two of which the government has conceded. The first principle on which we rely is that under Taylor versus United States and its progeny, undefined predicate offenses must be given their generic contemporary meaning, which Taylor tells us is the way that the predicate is defined in the criminal codes of most states. The second principle, which the government has conceded, is that the generic contemporary meaning of conspiracy requires proof of an overt act. And in fact, in his treatise, Substantive Criminal Law, Professor Lefebvre tells us that most states do indeed require an overt act. The third principle upon which we rely, which the government has also conceded, is that a federal conspiracy conviction under Section 846 does not require proof of an overt act. And the Supreme Court so held in 1994 in United States versus Shabani. For these reasons, we believe there was error that was plain in this guideline enhancement.
Tell me what you said about Shabani.
In Shabani, the Supreme Court held that an 846 conspiracy does not require proof of an overt act. And it settled a circuit split. This court had held that even before Shabani. So Shabani establishes that an 846 conspiracy doesn't require an overt act, which we contend makes it different from generic contemporary conspiracy, which does require an overt act.
Before you get to the third prong, I'm on the second prong.
Okay.
Given the fact that we don't have precedent that says that it requires the overt act, that we have a concurrence, I think, by Judge Higginson, discussing the generic criminal act. But given that we don't have that, how can we say that it's plain where we don't have a case on point in the circuit and you have to go through a series of analytical steps to get there? Why isn't this case like Ellis, for example, where it's complicated and there's no case on point, therefore you can't show the plainness of the error? That's my major problem with this case so far.
Well, I think to start with Ellis, that was a case that required a 50-state survey and trying to distill out what was the generic contemporary meaning of attempt, which is very difficult to do because you have to get into the case law, and it's very difficult to parse out even what state statutes mean because they're often altered by the case law. Whereas here, we believe that, as I said, our case rests on three very well-established principles of law: the Taylor generic contemporary rubric, the fact that we believe all the sources that we've examined show us, and the government has conceded, generic contemporary conspiracy requires an overt act.
So that's the crucial difference. Instead of it requiring a 50-state survey as to what the generic contemporary meaning is, the government has conceded what the generic contemporary meaning is.
Even had they not conceded, I still believe it would be plain based on all the sources that you look at. Professor Lefebvre has already done the work of looking at all the states, and he tells us that conspiracy generally requires proof of an overt act.
The
and I would point out...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry. You
go ahead.
I would point out this court has not required that you have a case squarely on point in order to find plain error. And these are not in the brief. I will 28J them, but I would point the court, for example, to United States versus Insalgarat, where the court held that Florida stalking was not a crime of violence under 4B1.2. There was no case on point, but the court looked at what Florida law plainly required for aggravated stalking, and the court applied its own principles of crime of violence law to that and found plain error. Also, United States versus Spruill, Judge Garwood's opinion for the court examined a Texas offense, a firearms offense, to determine whether it was a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence that would proscribe a person from possessing a firearm. And Judge Garwood wrote for the court, even though we don't have a case on point, the underlying principles are clear enough that we can find plain error here.
Well, counsel, it's one thing, and I certainly accept that we don't need, in some circumstances, a case on point, but it seems to me the definition of conspiracy as to whether it includes overt act or not, that issue is not just that it hasn't been decided by one of our cases. There's actually a mixed message that you get. When you look at the model penal code, for some crimes, overt act is not necessary. A minority of the states do not require overt act. It's not a constant. And so are you saying that if we, whether we do a 50-state survey or not, if we total it all up and if we get to 26 states, then that settles it? It seems to me my concern is the same as Judge Elrod's, that we have an unsettled point of what the contemporary definition is.
Well, again, I would fall back first on the fact the government conceded it in this case, but second, I believe that the consensus is clear enough. I don't know that it's a 26 versus 24 or whether it's some other split, but Professor Lefebvre tells us that the majority of the states require an overt act. And speaking of the model penal code, the model penal code also requires an overt act unless the object offense is a first or a second degree felony. But Professor Lefebvre tells us that even that exception to the overt act requirement in the model penal code has not generally been adopted in the recent codes. And that's in section 12.2B of Professor Lefebvre's treatise. So even the model penal code's exception to the overt act requirement, according to Professor Lefebvre, has been rejected by a majority of the states. I would also note that even under the model penal code, this particular offense is a third degree felony for which no overt act would be required.
Is the government's approach novel to look at the substantive criminal, federal criminal offense? Is that a novel approach, or have other circuits considered and adopted that approach?
None that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
In any context. I don't mean just on conspiracy. I mean on attempt. Any of these type of federal criminal statutes.
No, Your Honor. The clear rule, which comes from Taylor, so naturally the circuits are following it, is if the predicate offense is undefined, you fall back onto the generic contemporary meaning, which is gleaned from how most criminal codes define the predicate offense. No court has adopted the approach that you look at the federal definition, and as we pointed out in our reply brief, this court rejected that approach very specifically in Zavala Sustaita because the court said, we're not going to look to the federal definition of sexual abuse of a minor in 18 U.S.C. section 2423. We're going to look to this generic contemporary definition. So we believe there are cases like Ellis where applying the Taylor rubric might take an error outside the realm of plainness, but this is not one of them. This is a case where there are three very well-settled principles, and we have an unusual concordance of case law and secondary authority on this, and we believe that the error is plain in this case.
And we've already rejected the government's method of looking to the federal law.
Exactly, Your Honor. Now, I will move on to the third and fourth prong. I realize that they are somewhat controversial with the court. Nevertheless, I believe, turning to the third prong first, I think under this court's precedent, this error did affect Mr. Rodriguez-Escoreno's substantial rights for these reasons. First, with this error corrected, his guidelines would be at most 15 to 21 months, and he got a 48-month sentence. And this court has said, whenever you have that material a difference between the correct range and the sentence actually imposed, and where there's no indication in the record that the judge would have imposed the same sentence but for the error, the defendant's substantial rights have been affected.
And this record has nothing like that. There's not a, like, and I would do this anyway. There's not that kind of statement that judges often make.
No, there's nothing at all like that. And I think there are many cases that say what I just said, but I think this court's opinion in Mutacunye has a very good synopsis of this court's case law on that point in the particular context of guideline computation errors. This court, with respect to the fourth prong, has also said that in most cases, under these same circumstances, again, where you have a very large differential between the correct range and the sentence actually imposed, and where there's no indication the judge would have imposed the same sentence anyway, the fourth prong is also satisfied. And again, there's a very good discussion in the court's opinion in John that kind of gathers together all of the authorities from this court in this particular context.
We would certainly be in the minority of our precedent if we were to find this was not, did not satisfy the third and fourth prongs. Right.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think that the mine run of this court's precedent says that under these circumstances, the third and fourth prong are satisfied. And again, I realize some members of the court may not agree, but I believe that that is what the general tendency of this court's precedent is.
And there's nothing in this record that says, oh, well, there is an overt act, like in the case that the chief judge recently had that counter to the John case.
Oh, Chavez Hernandez?
There's nothing like that in this record that was a, you know, this really happened or it was an overt act. There's nothing like that in this record, right?
No, this is a very kind of bare-bones sentencing, so you don't have all of these things fleshed out, as in that Chavez Hernandez case, and you certainly don't have any indication that the district court would have imposed the same sentence anyway. And so we would ask the court to vacate and remand for resentencing. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Turner?
May it please the court. Jim Turner. I think we part company in this case on the issue that was squarely before the court, the district court. This is a 5-minute sentencing hearing in which the parties essentially agreed that a violation of Title 21 of the United States Code, Section 846, was a drug trafficking offense. Not so much that it was a conspiracy to commit a drug trafficking offense, but it was a drug trafficking offense. The district court was focused upon that. So our methodology is, why would the district court, first of all, there's no cases addressing Title 21 directly. And I think the reason for that is most of the Taylor litigation springs from litigation over the Career Offender Act and the Armed Career Offender Act. And there, Congress has specifically defined drug trafficking offense under 924C as a violation of Title 21. Clearly, a violation of Section 846 is, in fact, a violation of Title 21. Under 924E, Congress goes a step further and separates state violations and federal violations. And those are violations of the Controlled Substances Act. So what we have is a category of offenses which are drug trafficking offenses, not so much conspiracy. So what the guideline does, and what the guideline did first under Section 4B1 in 1989, I think, was to merge the inchoate offense and the substantive offense. What we have is an enumerated offense, possession, and it's by agreement. They agree that this is possession with a distribution of a controlled substance is, in fact, a drug trafficking offense. Hence, the 16 levels would apply. So under the first prong of the error, we would suggest that the district court, focused as he was, and by concession and, in fact, acquiescence with the defense counsel, this was a correct application of the law. Turning to the second prong, and this is where the 924C and the litigation surrounding this come into play. There's never been any litigation over Title 21 on these. The overt act requirements have always come up under state law. That was in the Fiore case, for example, that we cited in our supplemental brief.
So I'm sorry, can you go back to why you think it's correct?
I think it's correct, Your Honor, because the judge focused upon the fact that this was a drug trafficking offense. That is, it was a violation of what it did precisely was it was a prescription about the distribution of methamphetamine, distribution of controlled substances.
But that doesn't abrogate our responsibility to follow Taylor, does it?
No, it doesn't. And in this case, the question is if it's an enumerated offense, do you look to the generic issue? And we're saying that this is an enumerated offense, and a generic conspiracy doesn't come into play. That it is, in fact, an enumerated offense. It's a drug trafficking offense. It's a drug trafficking crime. Under Taylor, under everything else, it would be a drug trafficking offense, and that's what the district judge found precisely, that they merged. The inchoate offense and the substantive offense merged in this. That was the clear intent of Congress when they did
16. And what authority do you have that that's the proper analysis?
Well, the fact that it's a generic offense, there is no other authority on this because, again, there's no Title 21 United States Code sections addressed in this. Everyone, I think, has taken it pretty much for granted that a drug conspiracy under the federal law is, in fact, a violation as a drug trafficking crime, as a drug trafficking offense, would trigger the 16-level increase. There would be no other cases on that point, and that's what we look for in vain. With respect to the overt act, again, I think as Judge Southwick pointed out, there's a variety of cases. For most of the states, the only published authority so far is that the overt act is not, and not in this circuit, but it's in the other circuits. It's Fiore and cases cited after Fiore that the overt act does not bar application of the 16-level increase.
Have you conceded that the generic contemporary meaning requires an overt act, as your opposing counsel states?
We acknowledge it as opposed to conceding it. I mean, we have to acknowledge the fact that the law is what it is.
So the majority of the states, as Professor LaFave says...
Well, Professor LaFave in the Model Penal Code, but not Congress. In the end, I would think that the Sentencing Commission wouldn't trump Congress in merging these state and these offenses. So, yes, we would say that LaFave and Scott, the Model Penal Code, present one aspect of the analysis. But the other aspect is what did Congress intend, what did the Sentencing Commission intend when they initiated these provisions?
And the only reason that's relevant because it's an enumerated offense.
It's an enumerated offense,
and
yes, Your Honor.
Otherwise, we would apply the generic contemporary meaning, and your opposing counsel would be correct. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. And, in fact, if it were just a state offense as opposed to a federal violation.
Well, the fact that it's an enumerated offense, again, how does Shabani play into that? He was convicted of 846. It's an enumerated offense. The Supreme Court has said that you don't need an overt act. Why isn't that the end?
And Shabani issued in 1994, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. This guideline amendment, the commentary came into play in this guideline in 2001. So I would suggest that clearly Congress or the Commission knew that Shabani was there and that 846 was in that position where an overt act wasn't required when they submitted this commentary.
And they put it in the enumerated list.
They put it in the, yes, Your Honor. They did it just as they did under 4B1.2. They made it the inchoate offense is the same as the enumerated offense. So the analogy is to 4B1.2. And in fact, you have to go to 4B1.2 to find any of this litigation for the most part. 2L1.2, the litigation really didn't begin until they broke it down to the 16-level, 12-level, 8-level, 4-level increase. So with respect to that, we would say on the first two prongs, the district judge did not err, certainly did not plainly err, in accepting the acquiescence of trial counsel. And certainly, defense counsel was reasonable in that decision. They weren't derelict in not recognizing the error. The judge wasn't derelict, as no one pointed out to her, and the prosecution would think that a violation of 20 U.S.C. 846 is, in fact, a drug trafficking offense. The third prong, you don't have an elaborate record. Once again, it was a five-minute hearing, so there's no elaborate record on this particular aspect of it. The probation officer did point out that the that Rodriguez-Escarino's tenure in prison, his 5 years, wasn't unblemished. He did, in fact, have apparently five separate sanctions in prison, which would suggest that the court might give that consideration going to the fourth prong.
But the court didn't, but the district court didn't make any notation that this was a factor in why they were giving the sentence. Under our precedent, doesn't this appellant plainly satisfy prong three under Mudiquinha and other cases?
The problem we have with that precedent is it begins with Villegas. And in Villegas, you have a mandatory guideline sentence imposed. And 5 years after that, this sentence is we have a three-step process. And no one triggers the district judge or questions the district judge's reasonableness.
Right, but that's the problem with our precedent that we can't, as a three-judge panel, address.
No.
So you can see that under our precedent, he has satisfied prong three.
Under prong three, but not prong four. But not prong four, for sure, because certainly counsel was reasonable. And I can't see under the first two prongs, he doesn't satisfy it. Under the fourth prong, they suggested a 41-month term of imprisonment. Defense counsel said a 41-month term of imprisonment would be reasonable. We said something higher.
What case do you cite for the fourth prong where the sentence was so high, there is no other statement on the record by the court that they would give that sentence or that the person factually did what was talked about? What is your best case?
Your Honor, in all honesty, I don't think anyone's really discussed this in terms of the post-Booker analysis. So I can say there aren't any cases that really address this directly on.
But you recognize that you're asking us to do something different than John and other cases. You're asking
us
to step out. And so what?
Well, let me take a step back. Before Villegas, there was Mares. And in Mares, the court says that we can't tell that the court would impose the same sentence or a lower sentence. This would be going to the fourth prong. Then we have to, they don't satisfy the burden of showing plain error. Otherwise, they could come in, and I would recognize also that this is the same attorney, the same law firm, in essence, in the court below, that didn't lodge an objection, that said the guideline computation was fine. So it's clearly unfair to the district court to come back and say, you plainly erred in this instance, and we're going to send it back, notwithstanding the fact that not only did they say this guideline computation was correct, but we think a sentence within this guideline computation is correct, a 41-month term of imprisonment. So I would suggest under Mares, that last prong of Mares, which predates, and it's addressed in our brief, suggests that the court may impose the same 48-month term of imprisonment or not. It's their burden to show it, not ours.
But there is a vast body of our case law at this point when, after you satisfy the third prong and there's no other factor, would find the fourth prong satisfied, isn't there?
There is, but Mares predates all of them. And I would suggest that Mares is our strongest case. With no other questions, I will yield the remainder of time.
Thank you.
I would just like to briefly address some of the points Mr. Turner made. I heard him to say that conspiracy is somehow an enumerated drug trafficking offense, and that's not true at all. The definition of drug trafficking offense in 2L1.2 and, to my recollection, 4B1.2, where it's called a controlled substance offense, just includes a number of acts. And both of those guidelines separately break out conspiracy, attempt, and aiding and abetting in a separate application note. So it's not an enumerated drug trafficking offense, and there was certainly never any suggestion or concession in the district court that it was. Whether a conspiracy for any offense is covered turns solely on application note 5 for 2L1.2 and solely for whatever application note it is for 4B1.2. That's how conspiracies come in. Now, those define conspiracy for every object offense that is possible. And so the question has to be, since conspiracy is not defined, how do you define it? And the government wants you to believe that because 846 doesn't include an overt act, that should be the way you define it. But that's just contrary to precedent, because precedent says, under Taylor, you look to the generic contemporary meaning, and it's how It's defined in the criminal code of most states. So the issue is, what is the rule for determining when a conspiracy for any offense fits? And the rule we submit should be, does it have an overt act? Because 846 does not have an overt act, it doesn't fit. And we think that that is plain. And in fact, I again heard the government today concede that the generic contemporary definition of conspiracy requires an overt act. And finally, I just want to point out, in the district court, it's true, this was not objected to. We've said from the get-go, this is plain error. But we've embraced that plain error standard of review, and I believe have satisfied it. And the fact that defense counsel asked for a 41-month sentence is merely an indication that he simply didn't realize the error, and he was trying to persuade the court to do what he thought that court would realistically do under what everyone believed were the guidelines, which were 41 to 51 months. And that's not any sort of waiver. It's simply a good faith mistake about what the guidelines were and trying to mitigate damages for the client.
Well, he made a good faith mistake, and the government made a good faith mistake, and the court made a good faith mistake. Doesn't that eschew plainness?
No, because that's generally the case in every plain error case, is that no one has noticed it, neither the parties nor the court. And that's the purpose of the plain error rule, is when there is something that makes such a big difference that is plain, the court should reach out and correct it. And granted, reasonable minds may differ about when that should take place, but we believe that under this court's precedent, this is an appropriate instance for the court to exercise its plain error review and correct the error.
How is the integrity of the court system harmed by allowing the 5-minute sentencing to stand, given, you know, that this would be blindside the district judge, basically, if we send it back for this reason that no one thought of?
Well, in terms of blindsiding the district judge, I have to say that I think this district judge would appreciate the opportunity to sentence with a correct understanding of the guidelines. And I think the integrity of the judicial proceedings is impugned whenever you have someone that there's even a reasonable probability that they're serving extra prison time, especially when it's years of extra prison time on the basis of something that people didn't notice because of overwhelming caseloads that cause people just to make mistakes.
Would it be important for us to articulate whether or not what the correct standard is, regardless of the outcome of the case? And I'm not foreshadowing, because it's likely to recur in the circuit, or is this a one-off kind of thing about this overt act? Do we need to articulate this for clarity?
I think this is a recurring issue, and I think it would be useful for the court to say what the generic definition of conspiracy is, because it does arise in a number of contexts, not just the guidelines, but even statutes. Because, for example, the aggravated felony statute has a separate breakout for a conspiracy.
Thank you.
Thank you.